This week on the eBay for Business podcast.
At the time I started on eBay, I was one of maybe 10 guys out there selling expensive watches. In fact, when this idea came about, I didn't really believe much into it. It was my wife that really pushed me to say, you know what, I think this is a great idea. Because my whole take was, well, who the hell is going to buy $10,000 watches on eBay or $10,000 anything on eBay? It was such a new thing. And luckily, because eBay went that route, it gave me the platform and the opportunity to do that.
I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Griff. And this is the eBay for Business podcast, your weekly source for the information and the inspiration you need to start and run and grow a business on the world's most powerful marketplace. This is episode 150. Welcome back, Rebecca, and thank you in advance for filling in for Brian this week.
Oh, I'm certainly happy to be here, but 150, that sounds like a really huge number. I'm so excited.
You know, it is, and I've completely overlooked the fact that it's episode 150. So let's just wait till it's 200, and then we'll really have something to celebrate.
Yeah, we'll have a party.
That'll be next summer, I imagine.
50 weeks away. Yeah, it sounds right. Sounds right.
I look back on all the podcasts that we've done since 2018, that August when we started, and 150, that's a lot of content.
Oh, that's really impressive.
And most of it is still relevant. So if you're new to the podcast and you're just listening to these recent episodes on the website at ebay.com/podcast, you can find the podcast library and you can go all the way back to the very first podcast that we did. They're very different than the podcast we do today.
This is very true. When I first joined, about a year and a half ago, I went back and listened to some. First of all, I learned an awful lot.
Oh, that's good.
As a new employee. So that was really cool. Definitely, it's a very different experience, but it's kind of fun to take that look back. And then the last thing I would remind folks out there is, you know, eBay changes, policies change, tools change. If you go back and listen, remember that some of that information probably has been updated over time. So if you aren't sure, give a listen to the more recent podcast too.
Right. You'll always get the updated stuff here.
Absolutely. That's why we're here.
That's why we're here.
All right. So enough self-promotion. Who's on the guest roster this week, Griff?
Well, this week we'll converse with eBay seller Roman Scharf of Luxury Bazaar. Roman has a remarkable entrepreneur story to share with us. He literally built a multi-million dollar business on eBay. And from when I say from scratch, I mean from scratch.
I watched the eBay for Business short video of Roman, you know, the one where we ask him 7 questions.
Oh, yes, I saw that too. What'd you think?
He is tenacious and extraordinary. Like, what an amazing story. Let's make sure that we get the link to that video in the episode transcript for this week.
That's a great idea. I will do that. Before we talk to Roman, by the way, I think it's time to ask you, what's in the news this week, Rebecca?
The big news this week is all about promoted listings, and I'm going to actually just read the info to make sure that I get it all right, because it's a pretty exciting change. Promoted listings will be featured in external ads, expanding the reach of sellers' promoted listing campaigns and providing additional listing visibility across the web. We remain committed to providing sellers with the opportunity to be included in eBay's external advertising at no charge. Sellers will not be required to participate in external promoted listings in order to be eligible to appear in eBay advertisements on search platforms or partner sites. And it goes on. External promoted listings come at no additional cost to sellers.
Well, that's good news.
It is good news. Yeah, earlier I read at no charge, external advertising at no charge. And that's an important caveat. It's no additional charge on top of the current promoted listings costs. Sellers who use promoted listings will be automatically eligible to be featured in external promoted listings. Sellers who use promoted listings will not need to take any additional action.
It'll just happen.
That's right. And then finally, it is not mandatory to participate in external promoted listings. eBay sellers can opt out, and sellers who do not participate will continue to be eligible to appear in eBay's external advertising.
But why would you want to do that?
I know. It seems like a win-win, right?
You're not paying for that extra. By the way, when you say external, we mean outside of eBay's marketplace, so in other placements around the internet.
That's right.
I like that. Right.
So that's the news. Do we have questions this week, Griff?
Oh, in fact, we do. By the way, can you help out with them as you do all the time?
Yeah, I'm happy to come back. You know how much I love seller questions, but can I look them over first so that I'm prepared?
Sure. I'll send them to you via email. You can look over them while we're doing our next segment.
All right. I'll take a look for them, and then I'll be back to talk with you after you speak with Roman, and we'll get those answers.
Thanks, Rebecca. When he was a teenager, Roman Sharf immigrated from the Soviet Union, and as he puts it, he worked every job under the sun. He left his career at a Fortune 500 company to pursue his passion, selling luxury watches. His jewelry business now employs 30 people and has averaged $100 million in revenue in each of the last 5 years. He sells on eBay under the name of Luxury Bazaar. Welcome, Roman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What did you do prior to starting your luxury watch business?
Well, it depends on how far you want to go back. You go back to when I was 13, I delivered newspapers. If you fast forward to 18, I was in the military full time for 3 years. And post the military, once I went to school, I learned electrical engineering and computer science. I went to work more in the computer science field, first as a programmer. And my last corporate career, I managed global payment systems for a major international bank, which did about 42 billion in transactions monthly. I ran a team of about 12 guys out of Singapore that were 12 hours ahead of me. So as you can imagine, my management position was quite interesting, having to manage somebody in the middle of the night, every night. It was a demanding job that probably took about 60 hours of my work week. And around that time, I started selling watches part-time on eBay.
Why watches?
Watches is something that I've been passionate about. I think it combines some of my interests in engineering. It's something that, to me, showed sort of a status. Having grown up poor in a 400-square-foot apartment in Brooklyn, New York, and my father coming over here with $4 in his pocket, a watch always signifies some sort of a financial status. Now, I'm not a person that likes to flash. I'm not a person that likes to show off. But a watch was a subtle reminder of someone making it. It's usually something that stands for a somewhat of a status symbol, whether you're wearing a $1,000 watch or a $300,000 watch, right? But it also combined the marvel of horology. And I think horology is one of the most impressive engineering feats out there to begin with, dating back so many years and even till this day.
I always think about having a nice watch on as being not so much flashing status, but I appreciate quality. And a really good watch is kind of a masterpiece of what a human being can engineer out of little bits of steel and know-how.
Absolutely.
Watches and jewelry in general, because you don't just sell watches, you also sell high-end jewelry. It's a very wide and a very competitive category. How do you keep on top of that?
Well, I think experience is what helps you the most. For one, you have to imagine at the time I started on eBay, I was one of maybe 10 guys out there selling expensive watches. In fact, when this idea came about, I didn't really believe much into it. It was my wife that really pushed me to say, you know what, I think this is a great idea. Because my whole take was, well, who the hell's going to buy $10,000 watches on eBay or $10,000 anything on eBay? It was such a new thing. And luckily, because eBay went that route, it gave me the platform and the opportunity to do that. I had a jump start, and that jump start allowed me to gain experience, to gain a market share from the very beginning, sort of making a name for myself. And what made life easier is the fact that this was through a reputable platform already. If I were to go the website route, my website didn't open until 3 years after I opened up my eBay store. If I were to go the website route initially, I don't think I could have gotten as much opportunity to be able to sell to an end consumer simply from a trust perspective because the items are so expensive. Jewelry sort of fell into place after the fact. Luxury accessories fell into place after the fact because where there's watches, there's jewelry. It's sort of a comparable product.
Most markets are subject to trends. I assume that you're not immune to that. How do you stay on top of the trends?
Going back to experience and going back to knowledge. Knowledge is key in any business, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the watch or the jewelry business. Staying up with the market trends and more so having the diversity of products. I never once decided to specialize in a particular watch brand, a particular style of watch, a particular style of jewelry. What I ensured is I diversified across a multitude of things. When it comes to watches, it would be brands, it would be price points, it would be complications of a watch, style of a watch. On my eBay store, initially, you would find a multitude of different brands. You would find a multitude of different price points. And fast forward almost 20 years now, if you go on my website or my eBay store, you're going to find products from $10 to $1 million. You're going to find products in every price range, in pretty much every brand that exists out there, from a lower end brands. And by lower end, I mean cheaper brands to more expensive brands. Diversity helps because not that the business has grown to such a magnitude. It's not a question of me flipping watches over or selling bits and pieces of jewelry. It's a question of managing a humongous amount of money and spreading that amount of money across such a diverse product line that even if there is a shift in the market in terms of popularity, I have other things to fall back on.
There are customers in this high-end market, I assume, that are kind of like maybe one or maybe two-time buyers. They're looking for that watch they've always looked for. They buy it, they have it. But then there's a percentage of this market, and I count myself inside this percentage, who are avid collectors, which means they're obsessed with what they buy and they have to get more and more and more. What percentage of your customers do you estimate, if possible, are actual avid collectors who come back and buy more and more to add to their collection?
That's actually a metric that I keep a close eye on. Every single week, I run a multitude of reports in my accounting systems where I actually look at that. I'm glad you brought up that point. You're right. It would seem that majority of the watch buyers out there are a one-time buyer. Mm. More the reason to go back to the last question, why I tend to diversify it across, where, listen, a gentleman may buy himself a gold Rolex, a once-in-a-lifetime purchase at $30,000, but that same gentleman could buy a multitude of jewelry gifts ranging from $100 to $200, or even watches that up to $500. The one metric I will give you is the fact that, again, let's just take last year, for example, and this year so far, we're averaging out at about 64.4% of return clients. Is it easy to pinpoint whether or not that particular person is continually buying watches? Not so. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head, I can give you dozens of clients that I personally have known going back 15 years that are continually buying watches from them, and I can dub them as a collector. But there's trade-ins, right? People trade stuff in, trade up, trade down. Those people keep coming back. Does that make them avid collectors? Not necessarily. That makes them like me. I'm pretty ADD. So, you know, they get a watch and in a few months, they get tired of it. They want something else. They trade up, trade down, whatever it might be, right?
Yeah.
But the metric that I gave you of 64.4% of return clientele, that's something that I'm super proud of. And that's something I keep a close eye on.
Yeah, that's a really impressive figure. But you mentioned something that I was going to ask a question about, and that was the services that you provide to your customers post-transaction. For example, repair, or those buyers who are looking to trade up to a different watch, maybe a more expensive watch. How do you facilitate that?
That's something that if whoever is listening right now is an advice, you literally just answered your own question more or less. One of the things that I've always done from the very beginning, from the time I was literally sitting in my basement by myself running my eBay store, that's something that I offered right off the bat. I took the stress out of an expensive purchase. Number one, I did it with a return policy. This is before the times where eBay demanded that. This is before the times where eBay protected you with only PayPal payments. eBay was also in its early stages when I got on there, and all these things exist today. For example, the eBay authentication program, right? It takes the guessing work out of, we were the pilot for that, by the way, when you guys started that program. So you guys use this as a guinea pig on that one. But I did all those things before it existed. I quit with the introduction of escrow.com, which I think you guys bought as well. You know, that was a new company that popped out probably a year of me being in the business. I quickly jumped on and said, look, guys, take the stress out. Wire the money to an escrow company. You don't have to worry about getting a brick in a box. 7-day, no questions asked return policy. My saying was, I don't care if your cat doesn't like it. You can put it back in a box, send it back to me, no questions asked, taking that stressful part out of it. And then the after service. We provide a 3-year warranty on anything we sell. And this is a big to-do. It requires me to work with a multitude of service companies. It's an expense. Last year, my watch repair COGS account was at $238,000, just to put that in perspective, right? That's a $20,000 a month expense I take on by warranting these pieces. Now, the best part about it is my clients that come back year in and year out, they also know that just because they bought a watch from me 5 years ago, 7 years ago, something is wrong with it, and it's a minor repair costing $100 to $200, I will never bother charging anyone. Now, if you drop your watch out of a fifth-story window and it broke into pieces, I'm not exactly going to cover that. But for the most part, any minor repairs, any polishing jobs, straps, and things of that nature, I make it very personable. We're making a client feel special. And that's what it comes down to. It's about making a client feel special, making him like he is the number one client. And we do that for every single client through, again, our services, through our return policies, through our trade programs. When people buy something from me, I tell them right off the bat, I'm not the guy that's afraid to say, look, well, you're going to take this watch and you're going to take it out of my office. When you go to bring it back 3 days later, it's going to lose X amount of its value. Or this is something that holds value somewhat better. I tell everybody watches are not an investment. They're expensive toys, and to keep that in mind. But at the same token, I try to ensure that my clients have all the information up front so that when they come back to me a year from now and say, well, I bought this, you know, I'm not going to mention any brands, right? Let's not crap on anyone. But you bought this XYZ watch from me. When you come back in a year, you know, they come back in a year and they're like, oh my God, I paid you $10,000. You're giving me $4,000 in trade. My sales team, myself, and everybody here knows that don't try to give false information or withhold information that's going to result in a negative surprise from your client when they come back. And that's, I think, part of the reasons why we're sitting at that almost 65% return customer rate.
It would be an unusual expectation for someone buying a luxury watch to be guaranteed that, hey, this is an investment. You can make money on it in a year. That would be an unreasonable expectation.
Well, we do that as well, believe it or not. There are outliers in every business. And depending on market conditions, if you will, depending on experience that one has, there are clients that we have that come in for that very specific reasons. And even those clients, I tell them, look, anything can happen. Nobody thought Bitcoin would go to 60,000, or nobody thought a particular stock would drop down to whatever it may have dropped down to. Look at AMC, right? that was an interesting, it kind of worked out, but it didn't work out. And that's not mentioned GameStop, right? But I do tell the clients the following. Based on my experience and my team's experience, our company's experience, there are some watches that you can park money into that at a later time you can pull out and then cash out. But there's a caveat to that. There's always that catch 22. And that catch 22, when it comes to watches, is that I have to have control. Meaning that if I sell you this watch today, I'm the guy that's going to tell you when to sell it. At the same token, I also have a slew of clientele behind me that are looking to purchase certain things on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. So I have the opportunity to be able to take your money, invest it into something, then pull that money out at a good return. But even still, I tell people that watches are not an investment. If you want a good investment, buy Apple stock. That's just sort of been my thing forever.
I want to make a disclosure here that Roman isn't necessarily advising anyone to rush out and buy stock today.
I'm not. This is just a saying that I have to my clients. Okay. So no, I'm not advising anybody to buy any stock whatsoever. I learned a long time ago to leave that to the professionals, and I'm not a stockbroker per se.
Oh, you've done pretty well. So I wouldn't undercut your expertise in that field. I was in the antique business for years, and our advice to any customer who was going to buy something was always buy the best you can afford with the idea that you can trade up if you want to, but don't buy second best expecting it to be a good investment immediately. And it holds true, I suppose, for any field, including luxury watches.
At least you should mention that because the majority of those investment pieces that I talk about are going to be vintage timepieces. The modern market is so wild right now. It's absolutely insane. But there, vintage is always vintage. A watch that's 50 years old, 10 years from now, is going to be 60 years old. And the older something gets, the less there is of it. And as you mentioned, condition is obviously key, buying the best of the best. But one thing holds true is you're going to pay top dollar for the best of the best up front. And then it's a question of how long you're going to have to wait and figure out what the return on investment is. I guess the better way to put it is that it's a good idea to park some money somewhere once you have excess income. And this is happening right now as never before, with stock markets through the roof, real estate through the roof. Obviously, inflation is looming. A lot of people are taking their money and they're parking in these passion assets we call watches and just letting it sit there because in the back of their minds is, look, this is excess income that I would rather have elsewhere. Even if I lose or win 20%, I still feel safer than the 0.00 whatever percent I'm getting a return in the bank right now.
Exactly. I want to talk about something else that I did a little research, as I'm supposed to as an interviewer, and found that you have a really active social channel, specifically on YouTube. Your YouTube channel has nearly 72,000 subscribers. What's that strategy that you use for your social channels like YouTube?
So a couple of years back, my CMO, my chief marketing officer, Avi, came to me and said, look, we need a face of the company. And I'm like, okay. He's like, I want you to get on YouTube and I want you to start making YouTube videos. I sat back, I thought about it, and I said, look, I'm going to do what I've always done, and that's tell people how it is. If you expect some sort of an entertainment show for me to make jokes and things of that nature, that's not what I'm about. Ever since the very beginning, since I was working in my basement, I was lucky enough to run into a customer that taught me one thing and one thing in regards to educating your consumer. He said, you have to educate your consumer to a point where they would feel stupid to buy anywhere else but you, regardless of price, within reason, obviously. And I've kept that motto ever since I started. With that said, that's exactly what I started on my YouTube channel, and that was to educate my consumer. I started a series called What's on My Desk, where I literally showed watches. And I didn't talk about the nuts and bolts because you can find that everywhere online. I did get into a little bit of the nuts and bolts of the watches, right? Some of the basic functionality. If the watch was super outstanding, I would get deeper into it. But I didn't really get too geeky on the watch part, the horological part of it. I talked about its market value. I've talked about market value history. I talked about what this watch used to trade for, what it's going to trade for now, and possibly what it may trade for in the future. And at the end, I have an opportunity to play with such toys that, the rest of the world may have never even seen. So that's what I showed. Yeah. That quickly translated into a Q&A session because people kept asking questions. And I answered those questions honestly to the best of my ability without pre-recording any of this stuff. I did everything off the cuff. So I took a question, I answered it, my guys edited, put some funny pictures in there. That started to get a little bit stale because there's only so much one can look at a talking head at. So because those type of videos, they're a talking head. It's me against the background talking and showing some things. About 14 weeks ago, an idea that was born 3 years ago, which is what my CMO wanted me to do initially, we came out with a show called Gray Market. And that literally shows you what it takes to run a $100 million company a year. There's drama in it, that happens here every day. This is fully unscripted. Guys follow me around with the camera all day long, starting from our taping days of Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Wednesday, we have a meeting. Episode comes out Monday. Rigorous schedule, 3 videographers, costing me about $250,000 a year this far to produce this. But this is more in an entertainment genre because this is where the market is moving. People want to see the ins and outs of the industry. They want to see the watch born. They want to see the big transactions. They want to see me sell a $4 million watch. And we decided to sort of open up the doors and show the world what it actually takes with a goal in mind. The goal was set in the beginning to go from $100 million a year to $300 million a year. It's not going to happen in 1 year. This year, we're tracking to probably about $145 million to do this year. And hopefully the following year will get better. It gave us more exposure because the entertainment genre is better than a talking head. People still learn from the show, if you will. They see how the transactions take place. They see my meetings, my internal meetings where I talk to my team. They see my meetings with other colleagues in the industry. So it does have the learning aspect of it. It still has the watch porn aspect of it. But at the end of the day, it shows not just me, but it shows my entire team, allowing the audience and the customer to physically see that, A, this is what you're dealing with. They're looking at a 20,000 square foot facility. They see me go to my Hong Kong office. They see me go to trade shows. They even see how much I pay for stuff. So when they call me, they sort of have an advantage. They say, well, you only pay $10,000 for that watch. I'm like, well, I bought it right. Therefore, I want to make 20% instead of 10. And they're okay with that. It's full transparency is what it comes down to. And I think that bumps the trust factor through the roof. And I think it also helps with the tremendous amount of competition that's out there today versus when I first started. It was me and a handful of guys that I can name that started on eBay along me same time.
I've watched some of the videos. The Gray Market videos are very entertaining. We're going to put links to these in our episode transcript for 150 so that you can check it out as well. I was curious about something that I saw you quoted in on the other eBay piece on the eBay for Business page where you said you had a goal and the goal was to sell your business.
It's not exactly that way. Look, at the end of the day, we all want to see a big light at the end of the tunnel. And hopefully we're not the big, big light when we leave this earth. I'm talking about when it comes to your business. And my very goal is I want to get this business to a point where I have a choice. And that choice is going to be to sell it for a big chunk of money or to continue in the business, sort of step back, bring in the right people and allow the business to continue running, making a tremendous amount of money. Because in reality, if you look at any business, the time to sell is when your business is doing amazingly well. And the question is, define that very point. What's doing amazingly well? That's a point that somebody like myself is going to have a hard time doing over the next few years, because how do you define that point? Is $300 million a year enough? Is $500 million a year enough? What is that yielding in terms of profit? What is that doing for the people that are working for me? Because we may be a very corporate structure within Luxury Bazaar, but we're a very much family environment. Some of the guys that have worked for me have been here more than 10 years, majority of the company, right? It's a very tight family environment. So if I decide to sell, I'm not selling just myself. I'm selling for everyone that's here, starting from the guy that's packing boxes up to my executive staff. This is it's going to be a very hard number or a very hard, I guess, goal to define. It's a moving target and it's a moving target every single year.
What would you do if you sold the business?
I don't think I would ever leave the watch business. It would be a shame to sort of waste or not throw away, I guess throw away all the knowledge and the experience that I've had. I probably will stay in the business from a consultant perspective. And there's a very easy opportunity for me to take a chunk of money and park it with the right young guns out there in the industry, whom I personally believe in, help them out, help them grow their business, and in fact, get a return on my money just the same.
So doing good and getting a reasonable profit from doing so sounds like a good business plan.
Absolutely. Right.
Do you have family who would take over your business if necessary?
I have 3 children, and right now my oldest is off to college. He's off to University of Miami, but he's been running his own business, oddly enough, starting with eBay just the same, since he was 14 going on 15. And I'm proud to say that he's done extremely well for himself. Not only was he an excellent student, 4.23 GPA in a demanding school, got into all the colleges he applied to, got accepted to Northeastern, Babson, Indiana, University of Miami, et cetera. Chose Miami when we went to visit, and he saw the palm trees and the setting of the university. He said, you know what? I'm no way I'm going to Boston and freezing my butt off. I'm going to go ahead and go with Miami. But he's been running a successful business that's his own, starting at $2,000 at the age of 14. He was just about turning 15 at the time he started it. And considering the fact that last year he ended with $2 million in revenue, I don't know if he's necessarily going to want to take over my business. I've never planned to run my business to have family take over. I want to provide them the best environment, the best education, the best advice possibly for them to do what they want to do and never feel the pressure of, oh, I have to go into the family business. And none of my kids have that. I don't know if my oldest is ever going to get into my industry, because the way his business is going, I might be going into his industry. I might be investing into his business and becoming his partner rather than him coming on here and running my business per se.
Can I ask you what his business is?
Sneakers.
Of course, another current high-end market.
Yep.
And of course, it's doing well on eBay as well. So
his business started by me and my wife coming to him and saying, look, Marcus, you know how our business started. He's like, yeah, Dad, I know the story. It's eBay and blah, 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 blah. And you were working 80 hours a week and working, you know, walking 5 miles uphill both ways and blah, 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 right? He started the story a few times. So look, well, Mom has some older purses and shoes and stuff like that she would like to sell off, and eBay is the perfect platform. He got on there and it's like, oh, okay, this is easy. But the best part about that whole thing was is that he came to us 2 months later, said, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm like, huh? And he said, I'm getting the merchandise for free. I'm not doing anything to make this profit, right? You gave me a pair of shoes. I sold it for $5. I get to keep $250 for what? I didn't pay for those shoes. And that's when he went out on his own, started buying his own merchandise. And that's how his business got rolling. It was a very proud moment there. But yes, he started on eBay, moved on to other platforms like everyone else, and he's been doing pretty well ever since.
Well, continued success to him and to you as well. You're an inspiration to all sellers who are considering starting or growing their business. And I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy day to talk to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Roman Sharpe's business is Luxury Bazaar, and we'll put links to both his eBay store and his YouTube channel in the transcript for episode 150.
You got questions.
We got answers.
We actually have answers to the questions that sellers wrote in this week. Now, I went and researched these while you were talking with Roman, and I think I can help with some of the answers. But I do have some questions of my own about one of them.
Is it the Vero question?
You got it in one. That's right.
I can answer that one. It's a little complex. But I'll let you start. Shall we begin?
Yes. Our first question was emailed to podcast@ebay.com by Azalea's Books and Boutique Shop, who asks, has any consideration been given to being able to have text inserted in our photographs? I can see a number of uses for that. Thanks. Thank you, Azalea's Books and Boutique Shop. That's a good question. Text overlays are actually not allowed on eBay, and that's for a few reasons. First of all, they can be kind of unprofessional. Many people, I'm sure, would do them in a way that looks tidy and professional, but not everyone would. And we want to make sure that, especially for those sellers who are selling as business sellers, that everything that's in your listing looks as professional as possible.
Absolutely.
And then secondly, Google Shopping actually blocks any listing with text overlays or borders or watermarks. And they also block composite photos. We really want to make sure that your listings have as much reach as possible. Google is a powerful tool, and so making sure that everything in your listing is Google-friendly is something we super recommend, and actually build technology to make that possible. And then the third thing is that text information really should be confined to the description and condition fields, and that's because those are part of, again, getting as many buyers as possible to see your listings. Those are part of the search algorithm, and it's really best to put all of that information in the written portions of your listing.
That's what's not allowed and the reasons why, but is there anything allowed?
Yes, actually, there are some things that are allowed. First of all, you can include a sheet or a card in your item photo that has text on it. For example, you can put measurements on there, other important information. And so far as we can tell, Google does not seem to block those. The second thing that you can do is photograph a ruler or tape measure right next to your item to indicate a dimension, or you can put in a standard item. We see this a lot, a standard item like a quarter or a non-logoed soda can to show size. A quarter is always the same size. A soda can is always the same size. So you put one in your photo and it shows the relative size of the item that you're selling.
You actually see that a lot.
Yeah, definitely a lot.
And not usually in the first photo, but one of the subsequent photos in a series for a listing.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, in that first photo, that sort of kind of advertising of the listing itself and driving that first click in, you want to make sure that that is probably not with a quarter or other things that are a little non-standard. The third thing that's allowed is including a receipt or a card with your user ID. For some items, this is required, actually. For example, pre-sales or items which the seller doesn't yet have the inventory in stock, but will soon. What kind of items do we usually see that, Griff? Is that like the PS5 or something along those lines?
If there's a new gaming console coming out or a new Apple product and it's been announced and maybe the seller has actually purchased it, but it's not in their possession, but they want to get in on the market action as soon as possible, you'll see sellers put these up as pre-sales. And there is a pre-sale policy that you can visit on the eBay help pages too.
Good to know.
You did great work there with the research. That answer was spot on.
Oh, thank you. I had to look it up a little bit, but hopefully that is helpful for Azaleas.
Yes. Azalea, I hope that answered your question. And thanks again for including your shipping address with your email. We'll be sending you an eBay for Business podcast mug this week.
And our next question was sent to podcast@ebay.com also, and that was by eBay seller John. And John asks, what prompts eBay to remove a listing? I recently had 6 items removed for a Vero violation and 1 removed for excessive violence. Of the 6 removed for a Vero violation, I still have 6 remaining listings, and there are several other sellers with the same items. Also, with the movie removed for excessive violence, there are several of the same titles still listed. Great podcast, and thank you for always answering my questions. Well, John, thank you for always sending in questions. We love doing this. Griff, I'm not really familiar with the ins and outs of Vero. This is that question that I was hoping you could answer. Can you explain how it works for John and, frankly, for me?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I've been explaining Vero since the program began. I think it was back in 1998. John, there are 2 issues here. I'll deal with the first one, which is the Vero violation. I assume you know they were Vero because they would have come with that explanation in the email telling you those listings have been pulled down. What Vero is it's an acronym. It stands for Verified Rights Owners. And it's a program that eBay put in place, as I said, back in either 98 or 99. I believe it was 98, to facilitate a federal law called the DMCA. Which is the Digital Millennial Copyright Act of 1996, as it turns out. The act has a lot of text in it, but basically one of the things that it says and what it established was the responsibilities of a subscriber to a service provider like a website, the content that that subscriber puts up, and who's responsible if a rights owner believes that that content is infringing on their rights. I hope that doesn't sound too legal. If a rights owner believes that a subscriber, and in this case, that's an eBay seller, has put up content on the service provider's website, that would be eBay, that actually infringes on their intellectual property rights, which could be a trademark or a copyright, then the rights owner must inform the service provider that the content violates their rights, at which point the service provider has to immediately remove the content. No questions asked. So when you get a Vero violation notice and a listing removed, the rights owner for that product has requested, which is another way of saying demanded, using the strength of the law, to actually take down the listing. And eBay has no choice. eBay can't question the validity or veracity of the claim of the rights owner, and eBay can't negotiate on the content provider's behalf. The law is very clear. eBay, as the service provider, has to delete the content. We created Vero as a way to help facilitate these requests because as eBay, even back in 1998, it was clear we were growing a lot and there needed to be a mechanism where rights owners could sign up so that they could have a channel to let eBay know that there is content on the eBay site that has to be removed. And that's what Vero does. So a rights owner, and that can be anyone, that can be a big, big company or it can be an individual, signs up with Vero so that they can use the program to report what they believe are violations of their property rights, infringements, as the legal term. And then eBay, as I've mentioned before, has no choice. There's no question. the item gets removed. There is a process for a subscriber who has used the service and who has received, been on the end of a takedown notice to actually file a putback notice if they believe that the request for removing the intellectual property was invalid. And we don't actually facilitate that. That is not, the law says that we're not the in-between guy for this particular process. The, in this case, seller has to pursue that on their own. And my advice has always been, if you really believe that you've had a Vero violation and you believe it was not valid, then what you have to do is search out the process for demanding a putback. And it's a whole legal process. You might be able to negotiate it without a lawyer. You might need to get a lawyer. Once you've had a listing removed, unless eBay hears back from that rights owner through Vero and says this was a mistake, you can let it go back. It's not appealable. And if you've had a listing removed, the worst thing you can do without that approval by the rights owner is to put it back, because if you do, you're going to get suspended. If you have a Vero violation, I understand that it's frustrating, and you'll see other listings up there. Unfortunately, the only entity that can report a Vero violation or a, you know, rights violation is the rights owner or a licensed representative. A seller cannot report another listing as a copyright or trademark infringement if they're not licensed by the actual holder of that intellectual property.
Well, I actually learned a lot from that. I did not realize that there was any sort of putback process. Interesting to know that that's something that's directly between the seller and the copyright holder, and there's no appeal process with eBay. I know that Vero is a perennial topic that our sellers think about, but there's clever ways to get the message across. You can't say, for example, onesie, because Gerber, I think it's Gerber. But anyway, somebody owns that particular
term.
They do,
yes.
And we often see sellers asking about that. But there's other ways to describe a baby bodysuit with snaps.
If it's actually not a branded product, onesie, whoever the trademark holder is, then you can't use it to describe another product. We see this, I think the one everyone knows about is Velcro.
Ah, yes, that's an even better example. Yeah. Yep.
There's always the discussion, well, they're a big company and they shouldn't care. My response always is this: you spend an enormous amount of time and an investment of cash putting together a product that you're going to put your name on. This is your life investment. And then suddenly someone just copies it using your name. How do you feel?
Well, I mean, I think that's a great point also for our sellers. I mean, I'm not asking anybody to have tons of empathy for great, big, huge, you know, handbag companies or whoever might be holding a copyright. But I think sellers would not like it if somebody else came along and used their exact same store name and took their photos. And it's not unlike that. It's really just a piece of running a business is, you know, you invest work and time in creating unique and individual experiences for your customer, and wanting to guard that uniqueness makes sense.
If somebody is using your photos, you can register with Vero as a rights owner and you can report those listings through Vero. And believe me, they get taken down. So anyway, when it comes to Vero, there's a lot of information to know. So we'll also put the link to the Seller Hub page that talks exclusively about Vero in the episode transcript for episode 150. John, thank you for your question.
Thank you out there listening for bearing with us as we have this conversation.
And John, thanks for including your shipping address, and we'll send you an eBay for Business podcast mug straight away. It really is an indication of our gratitude for you sending in that question.
Yeah, we truly are. Thanks, John. Looks like those were the two questions this week. So if anyone out there listening has a question,
and you'd like one of our extraordinary gratitude podcast mugs,
why not call it into us here? And that phone number is 888-723-4630.
888-723-4630. You can call it any time of the day, any day of the week.
And if you are not a call on the phone kind of person, you can always email us at podcast@ebay.com. That's podcast@ebay.com.
And every week, as we do, it's now time for the podcast to-do list.
Attend eBay Open Online 2021, which starts, if you're listening on Tuesday, the day that this podcast release, tomorrow. That's August 4th, 5th, and 6th. And we hope that everyone out there registers and joins in. That's at www.ebay.com/open.
And if you've been listening to the past episodes, recent episodes, and some that are coming up, you know that we're going to talk a lot about the next topic. Don't wait. Start looking for inventory to sell during the upcoming holiday season. Do it today.
And then finally, check out the transcript for this and all episodes for follow-up on what you've heard and to see all those links that we referenced during the episode.
And now on our next episode, episode 151, we'll talk to a seller who also works here at eBay.
And we'll answer your questions, of course. We'd like to again thank our guest this week, Roman Scharf of Luxury Bazaar.
And I'll see you in a couple weeks, Rebecca. Thanks again for filling in this week for Brian.
Happy to be here, Griff, and I'll see you in a week.
The eBay for Business podcast is produced and distributed by Libsyn and Podcast 411.